Okay, I'd like to welcome you all here to today's briefing on Medicaid and what's happening, where are we? There's a lot going on, so we have a lot to talk about. I'm Marilyn Serafini with the Alliance for Health Reform, and the first order of business is I'd like to recognize and thank Ted Giovannis, who's in the room with us today, who's with the JKTG Foundation, and he's been sponsoring this series of briefings that we've done with reporters, and we feel very strongly about this because, of course, it gives us all a chance to sit down and really ask the questions of the experts in an informal setting. So I want to just recognize Ted, and Ted, do you want to say anything to the group?
The only thing that I would say, just for its background of our foundation, just go to our website, jkttfoundation.org.
Yes.
We undertake a lot of different types of research projects. This is what we call outreach, but some of our research projects are ones that you will hear about that you haven't heard about yet. Some of them are somewhat controversial, like replicability of studies that have been done. As much as 50% of all research that's been done is wrong. And it's for a variety of reasons, but nobody goes back and looks at it. But that's why it doesn't work in practice. The use of real-world evidence, both at the FDA and for other reasons, but there are those kinds of things that we're interested in. And we have ongoing projects also with cancer research and basic biology research. So there's a lot of things that we're working on that many of which other folks won't undertake. So with that, I just suggest you tune into our website and you'll be hearing more. Everything we do is free, and we're not soliciting money, so we're trying to make a contribution and doing it in a fairly unbiased way.
Great, thank you. You have a one-pager behind the agenda that'll help you to understand the JKTG Foundation and what they're working on a little bit better. It's in your folders. I'd like to take just a minute to recognize from the Alliance for Health Reform, Carl Eisenhower is in the room. He's our communications director. Carl, just wave to everybody. You can always reach out to him. We've got an enormous database of healthcare policy experts and folks around the country. So if you're looking for a particular person and you're not sure, you've exhausted your resources, call us. Talk to Carl or also Sarah Dash is in the back of the room right here. She's president and co-CEO with me at the Alliance. So feel free to use us. We have I believe some of you have, I hope, a bookmark in your folders also that tells you about our source book. We used to print it, all of you used to get it through the AHCJ, and now it's living on our website. We're updating it constantly, so if you need the latest data on Medicaid or Medicare, you've got the Medicaid chapter in your books, feel free to come to our website, bookmark it, and we'll give you the latest, and also the background. Okay, so let's turn to our panel. We do have a lot to talk about. Let me first introduce our panelists. We're really lucky today. We have a crazy expert panel with us. To my right is Trish Riley. She's Executive Director of the National Academy for State Health Policy and President of its Corporate Board. She's had two stints at NASHBE. She helped build it in the 80s and up to 2003. Then she was the director of the Governor's Office of Health Policy and Finance in Maine. And now she's back at NASHBE. And then to her right is Josh Archambault. He's a senior fellow at the Foundation for Government Accountability. So previously he spent some time in Washington as a fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and also he did some work in Massachusetts to then Governor Mitt Romney. To my far right is Joan Alker. She's executive director of the Center for Children and Families. She's also a research professor at the Georgetown University McCourt School of Public Policy. She focuses on health coverage for low-income children and families with an emphasis on Medicaid and CHIP and the ACA. I would just very briefly, can we just go around the room and could you just say your name and your affiliation so our speakers know who they're talking to today and they can assess how in-depth to get. Sarah, can you just start us off?
I'm sorry. Sarah answered with Bloomberg BNA.
Carrie Young with CQ.
Morning, Grabney with Gannett.
Shefali Luther with Kaiser Matthews.
I'm Rachna Kurlan with Politico.
Hannah Grantham with American Continental Group.
Robert King with the Washington Examiner.
Sharon Burke with MedPage Today.
Trevor Berry with USA Today. I cover the Deep South, Mississippi, Louisiana, Mississippi, California.
Julie Robner, Kaiser Health News.
And Julie?
Julie Appleby, Kaiser Health News.
We're overrepresented.
Never.
Chris Fleming, Health Affairs Blog.
Okay. Is that everybody?
You want just reporters or staff? Georgetown University Center for Children and Families.
Great. Good. Okay. So, Trish, take it away.
Okay. Given who's in the room... let me just talk a little bit about, you know, level set a little bit. My job is to level set, and hopefully we'll engage in a conversation with you, so let me just spend a few minutes reminding you, of course, of what we all know. Medicaid is now covers 73 million people. It's bigger than Medicare. The states have an enormous responsibility for a very complex program that is really four programs. It represents pregnant women and kids, people with disabilities, both physical and mental, the elderly, and now the expansion adults. It is a profoundly complex program, but it's been extremely facile in its life. When the AIDS epidemic occurred, it was the Medicaid program who covered when insurance companies were redlining Katrina, Zika. Flint, this is a program that's able to turn on a dime, as big and bulky and complex as it is. Let me just jump into the current debate, because I think it's a twofold discussion. One is a debate about federalism itself, and the other is about the role of the program. What is Medicaid's primary function? In the end, though, I think the discussion is about the money, who pays and how much. So I think that's the core question before us, sometimes disguised under other discussions. In the federalism debate, the notion of flexibility and block granting and per capita caps is really met at the state level. States have always asked for flexibility. I was a Medicaid director in the 80s, and I asked for flexibility. But it's a tension. How much flexibility versus how much cutting? And how much can you really save from flexibility? So the per capita cap proposal had a 25% cut in the program. The only kind of flexibility that would get you those kind of savings is to remove people from eligibility or profoundly restructure the program to be something quite different. So those are discussions about sort of the balancing act. And the reality is that even though the per capita cap would have been inflation adjusted by the medical CPI, Medicaid's costs have always exceeded that. So it would have been significant cuts. The second is the role of the program, and this is not a new discussion either. Here we hear that the program ought not to cover able-bodied people, it ought to cover the most vulnerable. It reminds me of the debates about the deserving poor. You know, who really is the program for? Its roots were indeed in welfare, but it moved in the Welfare Reform Act and in the ACA to become a low-income program, a program for low-income health insurance. This debate isn't new, and I think we have to sort of think back on some of that. The notion of the able-bodied ought not to be covered by the Medicaid program, they're higher income, they ought to buy health insurance. Certainly the Medicaid program serves higher income people. Look at those in long-term services and supports. They have incomes that are twice the poverty level, and we sometimes forget that. In the waiver initiatives, the waiver is a big part of the discussion, of course, everywhere at the moment. The earliest waiver that I remember was in the Reagan administration in 82, the Katie Beckett waivers. And here again, the discussion, the rub, who's the program for, is an interesting one. Is it for low-income people no matter what, or is it a program for those who are very vulnerable? And the Katie Beckett waiver, the first really big waiver, was around allowing families, regardless of their income, to qualify their profoundly disabled children for the Medicaid program. So that was an important first step, and it was an argument in the states about whether we could charge premiums. No, this was a Medicaid program, no matter the wealth of the parents. But then it switched. So you saw the next wave of waivers in Oregon. Legislator Dr. Kitzhaber, then governor, was an ED doctor, and he said, something's wrong here. I keep seeing people in the emergency department who are the working poor, and they have nothing. And there's the Medicaid program that has rich benefits for some people, but not for everybody. And thus was born the priorities list in Oregon and the very controversial 1115 waiver, where they basically set criteria about what were appropriate services, what were the evidence-based services, limiting services in order to expand. The 10-care waiver, where they moved the Tennessee Medicaid program into managed care, was also an attempt to expand coverage, as were all the managed care waivers in the 90s. It was to reduce and make more efficient the program so that it could cover more people. So this debate about able-bodied and who should get Medicaid is not a new one. And certainly, Secretary Price has signaled to the governors more flexibility for the states. When we look at the base, we see today the program is complex in large part because of its flexibility, because of the extraordinary number of waivers that exist in the states. There are 1950, there are all kinds of different waivers. Let's focus just on the 1115 that are the comprehensive reform waivers that are supposed to be research and testing of new ideas. There are currently 33 of those waivers operating in 41 states. So there's great flexibility going on in the states. The majority of them are around delivery system payment reform. Medicaid is alive. They're a big, big payer. They're alive with activities to really move from volume to value and by what matters. So they are by far and away the most waivers. And often they are funded by the ACA through the CMMI systems integration, SIM proposals. So even governors who deeply resent the ACA and wouldn't expand have embraced the funding for payment and delivery reform. Seven of them are the private option expansions, and I think Josh is going to talk more about the wave of those coming forward. 12 are for managed long-term services and supports, to turn long-term services and supports into a managed care program. 12 are for behavioral health, often with an opioid focus. And in Oregon, we see a new model emerging. In Oregon, Colorado, Illinois, New York, these continuing care organizations. It's sort of the new wave of managed care, the notion that, gee, we as Medicaid programs have been buying health care, but the population needs more than that, recognizing the social determinants, the frustration of seeing kids with asthma constantly in the ED and returning to homes that are moldy. So the notion that we can somehow invest and begin to sort of pay for some of the social determinants. There's a new round coming. Josh will talk about those. We'll see some, I think, around pharmacy. We'll see more around IMD, Institutes of Medical Diseases, so that we'll see mental health diseases, so that we can see more focus on opioids. But just let me close with sort of the state of the states, and it again returning to it's always about the money. 31 Medicaid agencies are reporting serious budget problems. Governor's budgets this year, while they did rise, they rose less than the 5.5% we've seen over the last couple of years. That's particularly true in the states that are fossil fuel dependent. They're in deep budget troubles. We need to always remind people states have balanced budget requirements. They budget usually for 2 years, and they have to balance their budget. Medicaid is always the challenge, and more so now as states confront the uncertainty before us. It's really hard to meet with your legislature and try to figure out a budget around a time when you don't know what the Medicaid program is going to look like in the future. Here's this program of $556 billion and 73 million people. And it looks a lot, the administration looks a lot like it did when I ran a Medicaid program in the 80s. We have not spent an adequate amount of time thinking about what it takes to administer this program. It's phenomenal what the states have been able to do with this program, the change that its adaptability. But the reality is the tenure of a Medicaid director is 19 months. The vacancy rate in Medicaid programs is 14%. It's a program where we don't invest in the management. We invest in program integrity, fraud and abuse. Boy, oh boy, we'll pay for that. But we don't invest in the management of the program. And finally, I think we will see some changes and some new discussions emerge this year and next. Important to keep in mind, the face of states is very red. States are Republican, governors and legislators. 33 governors are Republicans, 16 Democrats, one independent. In 2018, 36 of them are up for re-election. And of those, 28 are Republicans, 15 are open seats, 9 Democrats, 6 open seats. So I think the discussion about Medicaid and whatever the Congress and the administration does around it will be fast and furious in those elections.
Great, thank you. Josh.
Great. Well, thank you all so much for having me this morning. For those of you that aren't as familiar with FGA, we are a relatively unknown entity in D.C., so if that's, although we're playing here a little bit more these days, we're active in about 37 states. We're a think tank, and we work just on health and welfare issues And so we have been involved in DC more recently, obviously, because of the connection to states. And as we've talked to state leaders around the country and their frustration with, I don't want to say the lack of dialogue, but the lack of understanding at times of federal policymakers of what some of the state realities are, particularly on Medicaid in particular. I think I'm on this panel to represent a slightly different perspective, so let me do that. We hear a lot of frustration from states about flexibility in Medicaid. And while I don't disagree with Trish that the flexibility is, potential is there, I think a lot of states are frustrated for a variety of reasons. One, they have to come ask. They fund, partially fund this program, or half in some states fund this program, and they have to come ask, you know, father or mother government at the, in D.C., can I do this on my Medicaid program? They have to balance their budget. And when they come to Washington and they're on a 10-year budget window, and some states are on an annual budget, some are on every 2 years, those conversations aren't the same conversation about the flexibility in a program and how quickly you can change something, enrollment levels or benefit levels or whatever it might be that a state might be looking for. I think the average 1115 waiver takes over a year to get approval, which again is a problem when you're budgeting on a year-to-year basis and you want to try to change your program. With that being said, I think with the new administration here in D.C., it really is a whole new world for a lot of these Republican governors in particular as they're thinking through what do they want to ask for. And there's a fundamental question here. Do governors view Medicaid as a welfare program or as a health insurance program? Depending on how they answer that question, probably influences what they're going to ask for. So there's a number of governors who view it as a welfare program, so they're going to ask for things like time limits and work requirements, which, again, sound very familiar based on the welfare reform discussion. If they view it as a health insurance program, they might ask for more co-pays or penalties for not showing up to appointments or higher penalties for non-emergency medical visits, or you can't have unlimited mandatory non-medical transport. So these are the sorts of things that governors are thinking through, and Governor Bevin in Kentucky already has a waiver in for work requirements for his expansion population. Governor Ducey in Arizona will follow shortly. Kansas and Maine are actively working on and have already been public about major waivers that will be put in the next probably 5 to 6 months with a lot of these elements. And sometimes there'll be a blend of them, of the kind of health insurance and welfare things. And at times it will be for different populations because, as Trish said, there are different silos within Medicaid. It's not a uniform program. With that all being said, what happens with the repeal bill certainly is on a number of their minds, and expansion states in particular. I think there's a couple things that they're looking at. There's probably two camps on the expansion populations with what's in the repeal bill. Some who actually view it as a good off-ramp if they don't want to cover the able-bodied adult population for a variety of reasons. They're starting to feel the pinch in their state budgets. Of their share of the expansion populations, we pulled together data. Every state where there was publicly available data, enrollment was on average 110% of projections. And so the cost of that is starting to be felt in these expansion states as they have to start to pick up their share. So for them, they want to know how is the financing going to change in the future and how much flexibility are they going to be given on plan design. Can they do things like grandfathering? So think about pension reform. The current enrollees are held harmless, but then every new person that comes on is under a different scenario or different plan design. Or can we cap enrollment? Can we freeze enrollment? These are things that happen in CHIP and other areas but haven't been as widely applied in these other populations. So that's some of the thinking that's happening at the state level. I also know that a bunch of governors have actually expressed concern that Medicaid is the public health response to Zika and opioids and others. And so I think that I'm not sure they have a response yet on what to do differently, but I think they would like the federal government to think that Medicaid isn't the default for all of those things. And then the elephant in the room that will not go away, and I'm not sure where we go from here, is long-term care. It is an issue that is just crushing state budgets. Moving people out of nursing homes and starting to pay family members isn't always a silver bullet. There's a couple anecdotal examples in Minnesota where they actually started spending more money because family members were taking care of family member, elderly family members in their home for no compensation, and so all of a sudden you started paying for it. Certainly it saves a lot of money in most cases, but not always, and so I think states are really just scratching their head trying to figure out, how do you get out of this? Is there a trade-off with the federal government? They take all long-term care, and states take other populations. This is the sort of kind of out-of-the-box thinking that I think is there, and the block grant per capita cap proposal and conversation is actually a little bit more nuanced at the state level. I'm not sure it'll be more nuanced here, but at the state level it is, about what populations are in it versus out, what's the growth. We've been part of some of those conversations and seen documents of governors trying to really think that through for the first time in a long time, trying to, again, influence here in D.C. people's thinking. And it's a long, messy process, as you all know, but that's kind of what we're hearing at the state level.
So. Good. Okay, thank you. Joan?
Great. Well, thanks so much, and it's great to put a name to some of the faces that I've emailed with and spoken on the phone. I'm going to try to sort of just step back and offer some observations on some of these themes that we've been hearing about. It's a nice opportunity to do that rather than dive deeply into some specific states. But I want to really second Tricia's point that I think a lot of this debate is really about the money. And I'm not going to actually talk about the money. I'm going to talk about the debate. But I think at the end of the day, it really is about the money. And clearly, we could see from the exercise of the American Healthcare Act that Medicaid became the piggy bank. Medicaid was the source for enormous cuts, $840 billion in the final version. So, and that was by far the largest source of cuts. And so, so I think that tends to get obscured sometimes by this debate about state flexibility. And I want to spend some time unpacking that a little bit. Unfortunately, like many things, a lot of debates, I think, particularly about health policy, but really about anything, the facts get obscured by the ideology and the objectives that may be sort of hidden. Again, here I think it's about money. So the reason I think the state flexibility debate is flawed, and really you all have to question some of the assumptions that you heard here, is there's a couple of reasons. First of all, for those of you who don't cover Medicaid all the time, and many of you do cover it a lot, but I think those who have been around Medicaid for any period of time, there's sort of this famous saying, if you've seen one Medicaid program, you've seen one Medicaid program, right? Like, how many of you have heard that? Yes, I think mostly everybody. And that's because Medicaid is already very flexible. That's because states have a lot of options, not only through waivers, which we're talking about today, but also simply through state plan amendments and choices they make every day, every month, every year in their programs. And as a result, their programs look different across the states. So that's critical. And I think the second reason that I think it's very important to question the state flexibility debate is because, you know, state flexibility sounds sort of benign, right? And it's one of those sort of apple pie terms. Who wouldn't want states to have flexibility? Well, again, if you unpack this from a policy's perspective and think about it this way, because Medicaid is very complicated, we all know that, but if you think about what Medicaid is spending money on, it's really coming from three things: who you cover, what you cover for them, and how much you pay the providers to provide those services, right? So those are sort of very simply, those are the three things that you're spending money on. And the last of these three things, how much you're paying the providers to provide those services, states already decide that, by and large. They decide how much they pay providers. So that leaves you the first two areas, who you cover and what you give them, as the areas in which the federal government is now being approached for more flexibility. So you can see, as Joss has just alluded to, explicit requests we can see to limit enrollment, things like enrollment freezes or caps. That's a very clear limit on enrollment, will result in fewer people being covered. You can see less explicit, but also at the end of the day, restrictions on enrollment, like work requirements, like time limits. And then you can see restrictions on what you cover, both potentially benefit limitations. We have seen the transportation benefit was actually waived by the Obama administration. I think we can expect to see more requests to waive certain benefits. And the costs that families absorb in accessing those benefits, both higher cost sharing as well as higher premiums, which really fall in both categories, because we know from plenty of research that the higher premium it is, the fewer people will get coverage. So really, these new areas of state flexibility, when you unpack them by and large, and the action we're going to see in the months coming forward as this becomes increasingly important in the Medicaid program, is in restricting the number of people who are able to get on the Medicaid program, stay on the Medicaid program, and limiting of what they get or increasing their costs. So I, as folks know, have a lot of concerns about these approaches. I think fundamentally they reduce access to care. I think that's short-sighted. Both is it unfortunate for the beneficiary and the vulnerable folks who rely on this program, but I think from a healthcare policy perspective, it's short-sighted. Because simply because we limit somebody's access to care does not mean their healthcare needs go away. And in fact, their healthcare needs get worse, and their chronic conditions get worse, and they might wind up in the emergency room, which is the worst place to deliver care. The other aspect of these kinds of approaches, like Indiana, like Kentucky, and others that we will see coming forward, is that they're extraordinarily complicated and involve very considerable administrative outlays, new systems, new contractors to run all different aspects of these programs. And really, frankly, on the ground, nobody understands them. And you're starting to see more research about that. But to imagine that a system as complicated as Indiana, you know, I think at one point we counted 6 different benefit packages under the waiver, to imagine that it's not just the beneficiaries who don't understand it, it's the providers, it's the eligibility workers, and the people who have to make the program run. So this is a problem. So fundamentally, I don't think that these programs actually meet their stated objectives in a number of ways as well. So with that, I think just to note that we will continue to see more and more waiver activity, I think, although at the moment I would say the real activity is emanating from those states that are red states that did expand already, but they had a waiver approach, and now they want to modify their waiver approach. And it's worth noting that some of these states, these changes are not actually emanating from the governor, they're emanating from the legislature, where opponents of expansion originally lost, and they keep coming back and saying, well, we want to make changes, we want to nibble around the edges. And so we see that in Ohio, we see that in Arizona, and Kentucky, of course, where Governor Bevin ran on an anti-ACA platform and inherited the Medicaid expansion. So a lot of these tensions is, as I said before the election, is true now. The Medicaid expansion itself is a purely Republican fight within the Republican Party. It is not a partisan issue. It is a fight within the Republican Party, and I think you're going to continue to see that playing out. And particularly if Congress ultimately does not act with respect to repeal and replace, with respect to Medicaid reforms, most of the locus of the activity around Medicaid will focus on the waiver process. This is exactly what we saw happen in the Bush administration. Early on in the Bush years, there was an attempt to block grant the Medicaid program, didn't get very far at all in Congress, and as a result, they moved to a waiver strategy. So that's certainly something we could see here. So with that, I'm probably out of time. I'm going to hand it back.
That's great. Thank you. So in a moment, I'm going to turn it over to you all for your questions. But we've spoken. I'm going to just take the opportunity to ask the first question and dig a little bit deeper. We've been talking in general terms about what states generally are looking for, what we're seeing generally. What specifically, who's doing what right now? Are we seeing a handful of states that are still looking to expand? Is that going to happen? Is that impossible? Do we have, are there particular kinds of waivers? Can you give us an example of where we're seeing this and who may be moving forward? Can we just try to get a little more specific?
Quickly answer that. I was sort of getting there when I was talking about we have this group of states, you know, it's under 10 states who did expand, who already had approached their expansion through a waiver, but who may be coming back to make some modifications. So I'll give the example of Arkansas. They're going to have a special session, I think, next week to make some changes, which will appear in a waiver. Arizona has an amendment that will be coming in shortly. It's received public comment at the state level. It does have a work requirement, time limit, things like that. That was something that the Arizona legislature passed a few years ago, and they said to the governor, you must submit this waiver every single year. If it's denied, you got to go back the next year. So that's why Arizona is doing that. Kentucky, of course, I think Josh mentioned this, Kentucky is pending. That came in the last administration. And basically, after the election, the last administration decided they weren't going to decide on that until the new administration came in. So Kentucky is pending, and I think Kentucky may be the first significant waiver decision we see. I'd be curious of both of your opinion on that. And then we have a few others as well, but I think that gives you the flavor.
Indiana's renewal.
Indiana's renewal, yeah. We have a couple of states that really fascinating are looking at moving forward on expansion potentially, even in this very uncertain climate with a possible repeal. I think folks probably saw Kansas. The legislature voted to expand right around the time the repeal and replace was being debated, which I thought was really pretty interesting. They are having a special session, and that issue is going to come up again. North Carolina is, I think, more of a long shot, but we did see some Republican legislators there, particularly interest from the rural health community there to think about some kind of expansion. So we do have a couple of states, again, they're all Republican states, who are, despite where the national climate is, having some pretty active debates about picking up expansion. And I would expect both of those would have approach it through a waiver.
Yeah, I actually don't know if I agree with your assessment that it's just expansion states asking. I mean, Governor Walker is putting together a waiver request. Maine and Kansas, who have not expanded to this date, are putting together requests. I think what's interesting about this is that Kansas is not in a vacuum. That was a concerted effort by the hospitals to fund candidates who said they would vote for expansion. So I think what happens here in D.C. makes a big difference, obviously, as we've been saying, the funding. But you also have states like Oregon saying on the table is maybe ending expansion because of the budget crisis. Now, is that likely to happen in Oregon? Probably not. But it's an active discussion, and that should tell us something about the pressure that states are starting to feel on the budget side. So I just, again, we can cherry pick back and forth. I don't expect a ton of action on expansion over the next year or so, Kansas being one of the exceptions because of this multi-year campaign by the hospitals, because I think folks are starting to look around the country. And let me just make one side point here that I think almost never gets covered. This is not a purely ideological issue or even partisan issue. There are people at the state level who have waiting lists that are concerned about disabled populations, or they have public education concerns, or they have infrastructure concerns. And let's not kid ourselves to say that you can spend $1 twice. If you expand and you have state dollars on the table, that is one less dollar to be spent on something else. And so there are genuine people who are not mean, who are concerned about these things at the state level, and they have to write this budget every year and make really hard decisions. And the expansion discussion makes that conversation even harder going forward, with the caveat, let's see what happens at the federal level.
Yeah, but I think the federal discussion has somewhat of a chilling effect on those states that want to do really creative reforms. And I think we have to be cautious about leaping to the Oregon discussion as a legislator. In Maine, Maine's a great example. I live there, so I watch this every day. And it's the governor very much has proposed a waiver that's very much like the Arkansas one: work time limits, work requirements, the works. The legislature is about to consider an expansion proposal that's been vetoed 6 times that passed through because it's going to a citizens' referendum. A citizen referendum to expand coverage. So there's the yin and yang across all the states. The issue of the waiting lists that you do hear often from conservative states who very much favor limits to the Medicaid program, keep in mind the waiting lists are for expanded services. They're for waiver services. Those populations of disabled people still get regular Medicaid benefits. So it's not a waiting list for services. And I would just finally end on the CHIP example that Joan talked to us about. CHIP is a program that had waiting lists because it was a block grant. But look what happened. Every time there was a waiting list in CHIP, the Congress expanded the appropriation for it. So, isn't that interesting that every time there was a real rubber hits the road where people weren't getting covered, there was a new appropriation, so effectively it didn't work quite as one would expect a block grant to work.
If I could just jump in on this expansion, creating these waiting lists, I think that is a very flawed argument. There is not only...
I didn't say create a waiting list. I said complicates the situation.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess what I would just raise for everybody is that if you're concerned about pitting vulnerable populations against each other, the worst proposal that would create such a situation would be to block grant or per capita cap the program federally. That is exactly what the American Healthcare Act did, and that would pit vulnerable populations against each other with declining federal funds and states having more ability to make cuts, which they would have to do with the cost shift. So to me, that's the worst nightmare, is the cap, the block grant. That will lead to pitting vulnerable populations against each other. We just had a new study last week in Health Affairs that showed that the Medicaid expansion had not impacted state budgets, frankly, positively or negatively.
With 100% federal dollars.
And it wasn't pitting it against education funding. So,
put that aside for a second. I just think it's a broader question here that, do we believe that Medicaid delivers value? What's the point of Medicaid? Is it to get as many people on it as possible? Or is it to make sure that the people that are on it have good access and good quality outcomes, and the people that shouldn't be on it aren't, or the people that can be on some other source of coverage should be there instead? I think that's the ultimate question, and I think we instead, right and left, have a Medicaid is amazing on the left, and on the right, it's terrible and never delivers value, right? That's the dynamic we have frequently in these conversations. And I would like to at least think that we could somewhere end up in the middle of some sort of compromise to say, okay, for the truly needy, this is the commitment we're going to make to them. You know, 13-year-old in Arkansas who can't speak and has 10 seizures a day, who is waiting for, yes, additional services, but her mother can't basically leave her, that we're not going to be able to fund services for her, versus our goal is to make people work-oriented and get them back into private coverage, which in a lot of these expansion states, a lot of folks were on private coverage previously, and allowing states to have some flexibility there, or CHIP, like why do we have kids on Medicaid when their parents have private insurance? Put them on the same coverage at least. I mean, those are the sorts of conversations that I'd like to be having about what's the future of Medicaid versus we need as many people on, and if it looks different, then we're throwing all these people off, and it's terrible. Yeah, we should have conversations about consequences, of course, but I don't think it happens in a vacuum. You have to look at kind of the private market in relation to Medicaid.
And couple that with the reality that America has a great poverty problem. I mean, the question of these populations and where populations who are the working poor, and most of the expansion population work, where they can afford coverage. So you either use the Medicaid program or you deeply increase the subsidies available to buy private coverage.
Okay, let's start here, and then, okay, we got lots of questions.
You guys have already touched on this, but can you talk in a little bit more depth about Arkansas, what it is they're doing now, and how it is they want to change that?
I don't know what they're voting on, but is it what the governor proposed a couple weeks ago?
So I think there are three things,
if I can remember
them.
They're doing now, because I forget.
Yeah.
So
they essentially, Arkansas decided they're doing something called the private option, and what they decided to do was to buy coverage in the marketplace for their expanded Medicaid population. So it was kind of a unique situation, I think, because Arkansas didn't have managed care, and I think that was one of the reasons that they did this. And so they've been buying marketplace coverage. So one of the things that the governor has said he wants to do is to roll back coverage to 100% of poverty and maintain his enhanced match. And then those people can go into the marketplace 100 to 138%, which...
But is that what they're already doing? That's why I get kind of confused. Aren't they buying more?
But he wouldn't pay for them.
He
wouldn't pay any more of the state share. They would become eligible for the federal subsidies. They would be out of Medicaid.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's ironic to have this discussion at the time of repeal happening. And there's a few other things, including...
There's some work search type requirements that he's talked about. And I think what's interesting in Arkansas is This has remained a contentious issue its entire life. Almost every session, there's at least one or two bills to defund or end the program. And I do think, I mean, again, you could say it's by the people who lost, but it's not settled, is my point. And there continues to be in primary, I mean, we saw some of the mailers for the last campaign cycle for legislative races, and it's popping up in mailers for state legislative races. So it is very much alive and well as a debate.
Well, Kansas, it was down to the last vote.
Correct.
Well, it's unique in that every single year they have to appropriate the state funds.
Funds, yeah.
That's a unique situation.
So it comes
situation.
Up as a discussion.
So it comes
yeah.
up every
yeah.
year.
Yeah, that's yeah. right.
So. Okay.
Two questions about the waivers. One is it clear what CMS can do, can leave on its own without changes to the law, such as removal requirements? And two, you mentioned that there were so many of these waivers already out there, and the waivers are supposed to be testing theories about better ways to run the program. How good is the evaluation of whether the waivers, whether things that are being tested work or not? What have we learned anything from all these waivers about what works and what doesn't?
Depends on who you ask, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, Indiana is a perfect example where then Governor Pence, there's a requirement for an independent evaluation. The independent evaluation was done by an organization that the governor pointed out had criticized the private option. Therefore, he has his own evaluation in place, and most states do. So what you often have is dueling data, and it becomes pretty unclear what the data necessarily tells you. The evaluations also take a long time. And in political, the reality of, you know, pragmatic states, the evaluation might happen years later or too late, and the legislature already makes a decision. They make a decision without the evaluation based on what they think people are achieving, what the costs are, and what the value is. So as much as I love data-driven policy, it's, what is the plural of anecdote? Policy. And I think that's the reality on the ground. It's really, these evaluations do a great job trying to get real-time data, but it's very hard, not the least of which are some of the data problems that exist currently.
Yeah, I would second that. I would go out on a limb. I certainly don't think this is going to happen, but I think we could use Congress to come in and include some language to have stronger evaluation requirements of these waivers. As you say, they are intended to be demonstrating something new, and they really, frequently when you have the state paying the evaluator, there's an obvious conflict of interest there for the evaluator, but if you don't have the state paying the evaluator, a lot of times the state won't hand over the data the evaluator needs. So it's a
well,
difficult
situation.
Well,
and states do want to know what works. I mean, it's not, you can't
Absolutely.
Be so cynical.
Yes.
It's, you know, there are real needs for states to know what works.
No, and many of these evaluators, frankly, I think are doing a good job. They're trying. They really are trying. And there's either, you know, political constraints or time constraints, you know, or data constraints.
But there's also, to Josh's point, the notion that the states have, you know, Arizona's became a Medicaid program with an 1115 waiver. It's been going on for decades. So when does it prove that it works? And so there's some discussions that we know what works, and those should not be waivers, and they should be simply applied as a state plan amendment.
So I was just going to say two quick things. I can't underscore enough. I don't know how many of you have had a chance to go to a Medicaid agency, but the data challenges in some of these agencies. I mean, I think I was in one that effectively they're running their program, and this is a little glib, but often Excel spreadsheet. But it wasn't far from that as far as the IT, and some of that's changing. They're spending hundreds of millions of dollars in most of these states to change some of that. Hopefully it gets better. But to answer your first question, and chime in if you disagree, I think the ability for CMS or HHS for what they can waive is broad. There are some general kind of principles by which they're supposed to meet to authorize waivers, but it's pretty big. And I think this is actually some of the frustration by states of saying, in theory, we should be able to do a lot, but it depends on the bureaucrat who's sitting in those offices at the moment, and it's temporary. So you authorize our 1115 waiver, well, maybe 3 to 5 years from now, you change your mind, or an administration changes, and all of a sudden you may not have that ability to do the same thing. So I do think that is a consideration for states and a frustration for them often. And that's not just a red state frustration. I've heard it in blue states and purple states. for them to just say, like, oh, a new administration's in, I wonder what they're going to do. Now, they don't frequently poll them, but they can poll them at any time. And so, again, that for them is just feeling like, we really feel like a partner when you can do whatever you want, or the three or five people making these decisions can say, we don't agree with that, so we're not going to authorize it, even though you're putting money on the table to pay for this program, too. So.
I just add a couple things to that. First, I generally agree with Josh, and I'm going to propose something that maybe we can agree on going forward as a reform. But there are limitations to what you can waive. The way the statute is structured, it references certain parts of the Medicaid statute. So there are certain parts of the Medicaid statute that are outside of that, like, for example, the matching rate and the matching structure are not in the part of the statute that you can waive. I think there are a lot of questions about certain issues, which, not being a lawyer, I'm not going to opine on, but, for example, whether a work requirement is something you can impose, whether that's consistent with the objectives of the Medicaid program, which is the broad authorization. I imagine we will see these legal questions play out. Mm-hmm. So I guess the one issue I was going to propose, Josh, that maybe we could find some common ground on is I think we all agree there's a data problem. I think that's been getting better. There have been efforts to make that better, but I also think there needs to be resources, to Tricia's point earlier about focusing on the management of the program. But something we've been very interested in, for example, is the child core indicators that were included in CHIPRA, but they're not mandatory. So states, not even all states, report them. So you can't compare across states. So, but that's going to require some mandatory actions on states, which, again, may be problematic in your view, but we would love to have 50 plus DC, you know, states where we can look at the data, compare it. But I think that's going to require resources, and it's also going to require states to put that as a higher priority, which I don't think they should be asked to do unless they get the resources.
Okay, yes.
Here. So I have a two-part question. First is, since we've talked about work requirements, and it seems like all but enough of all that we're probably going to have a state that gets one approved, how much of a fight, like legal, you know, whatever fight do you think this all is going to result in if, you know, CMS approves something through waivers? So if you could just talk about what you anticipate on that. The second part is, of course, you know, we, and myself included, tend to focus on the expansion population a lot, but of course that's not really what the cost driver of the program is. So could you talk about what you think, is there anything new happening in the states on trying to contain, you know, for the elderly, disabled, you know, the populations that are really the most expensive in the program?
I assume there will be a legal challenge on the work requirement side. I honestly think this is an 80-20 issue. 80% of the public supports it. So for what that's worth. I think the other thing is, I actually don't think it's that complex. States have a history of a work requirement for SNAP and for TANF. What's in the American Healthcare Act is that something that looks more like TANF. One of those thresholds is work search. I don't honestly think that that's that big of a hurdle. That for most populations that it would apply to, and again, let's be very clear, this is not a work requirement for children or something like that, or somebody in a nursing home. It's not applied across the whole program. But for individuals, if we believe, again, if the goal, and if one of the takeaways from welfare reform, and perhaps we'll have disagreement on this too on the panel, but one of the takeaways was that work was really important to getting people out of poverty, then it would make sense that some sort of work orientation of some kind could also work to get people out of poverty and off of Medicaid. So I think that there is a strong policy case to be made of saying, if we believe it works for single moms on TANF, why do we believe that able-bodied adults without dependents, which is most of the expansion population, shouldn't have this? Or if they're on food stamps, they have a work requirement, but not on Medicaid. I think there's a legitimate policy discussion to be had there. The legal questions, you know, we'll just have to wait and see how that plays out.
Doesn't it go back to your question if this is a welfare program?
Or not, because it also applies to health insurance, because the data, the research is pretty clear that people who are working are healthier, right? And that work is a really important piece of recovery, and you know, there's this massive literature review out of the UK looking at the value of work for all these different subpopulations. Folks that we don't tend to think of, and you'll meet some, I mean, just go to states and talk to the disabled advocacy community. They view work as a huge, huge part of kind of for folks that they're advocating for that community. And you talk to folks in addiction, and talk to folks with in mental health areas. And so I think there is an openness here from some state health and human services and Medicaid directors to say, we need to think about this differently, and work might be part of that. Or work orientation, or whatever you want to call it.
I think that when you're a Medicaid director, you're sued all the time, and it's the reality of the life. And I think we will see suits, but I don't think the work requirement is as contentious as the limits would be, as time limits on a health program. So I think we ought to take a hard look, and it depends on how they get played out and how they get crafted. And among the kinds of issues that keep Medicaid directors up at night, I'm not sure work requirements would be one of them at the top of the list. Certainly you hit on, and I think Julie hits at the point, is it welfare, is it healthcare, and what do we do? To your second question on the cost drivers are increasingly children with healthcare needs, special needs kids, children and youth who have very significant health problems, and who may be the people who families who are putting kids into the Medicaid program because of the richness of the pediatric benefit and the care that they can get. It's people with physical and mental disabilities. Long-term services and supports, the rate of growth in those costs is in check, even though the population is huge and they spend a big part of the costs. Around that long-term services and supports, the issues with, Josh brought up the trade-off, but that becomes terribly complicated, but it's an issue that surfaces all the time. But it is the issue of the dual eligibles, those low-income people who are eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid. And this is a rub for the states. On the one hand, states have to use Medicaid dollars to buy people into Medicare coverage and argue that ought to be a Medicare requirement. Increasingly, states are putting those folks in managed care, but are having a tough time making that work because of the Medicare rules, one of which is choice. That patients on Medicare get full choice, and in Medicaid you get to lock them in for a period of time in managed care. So the managed care entities argue, how can we manage care if people can come and go? So that issue around, you know, we might see waivers and requests from states there around the duals. There's always the anger about the clawback that when Part D came into effect, Medicaid thought it would see savings. They've been paying the drug costs for dual eligibles for a long, long time, but in fact they have to pay a clawback. So those are some of the issues. The biggest area of activity around the states is around behavioral health, and trying to figure out how to connect behavioral health with primary care, much activity around managed care, new discussions around the opioid crisis. And you'll see states asking for permission that is now not available to put folks in institutions for mental disorders, IMDs, mental health hospitals, to deal with substance abuse. It's always, everybody's afraid of, again, creating the massive institutions that was so problematic in the culture. The states are saying, no, given this epidemic, we need new strategies and new tools. So I think in many respects, the behavioral health work is the most active work around the states, and where we'll see lots of activity.
I just had one small thing to that. We've actually heard some chatter about they're calling them mega waivers, and I think Speaker Ryan, maybe opportunity accounts or something, with welfare reform likely to come up at some point here, CHIP reauthorization as well, but there might be a conversation around states getting funds across programs, so housing and others, and I think the dual eligible pilots have had a real mixed record, and there's some belief that, well, could we, if we had less siloing and more flexibility around the funding for this, then maybe we're able to treat people in a better way, coordinated care. That's going to take a real state leader to step forward. I mean, I could see somebody maybe like Governor Walker or something. I don't think there's a lot of governors positioned right now to be able to take that, but you might see a Democrat and a Republican see an opportunity and at least make the argument of these three or four programs, we want to braid their funding together so that we can better take care of people. We'll see.
I'd watch Washington. Kate Brown.
So a quick question about high drug prices and how they fit into kind of the reforms that we're talking about, like block grants and everything. Isn't that, do block grants and per capita caps really kind of take into account the strain that high drug prices have on Medicaid budgets? And how would that impact the overall debate too?
Next question. I think they've obviously been an enormous driver. You look at the Hep C example, where it's the disproportionate numbers of people on Medicaid, you know, obviously have hepatitis and could have been saved by those drugs. And there were court challenges. There were all kinds of activities. So it's a very high and unpredictable cost driver in the Medicaid program, complicated by the way the Medicaid program federally in the states deals with drug prices, which is a very complex rebate system. So the notion is, I'll give you a rebate, and you put my drug on your formulary. And states get supplemental rebates as well. We're seeing more and more states start to think about, maybe we want to think differently about this. Maybe we really want to be able to constrain our formularies. And I think there'll be more discussion about whether and how the Medicaid rules around pharmacy play out. And there will undoubtedly be some waiver requests to change that. And the Medicaid program is required. This pharmaceutical manufacturers are required to pay best price to Medicaid programs, and as other state agencies get engaged, and we're pretty active with them, trying to reduce drug prices for employers where it's really been an enormous challenge, they get into challenges with the Medicaid program because you don't want to conflict with Medicaid's best price rules. So it's a really complex array of policy issues that make it really tough for states to address the issue.
I think it speaks to exactly why the issue is not Medicaid. It is a healthcare systemic issue. Mm-hmm. Drug prices. I mean, if anything, Medicaid is probably doing better because of the rebate than other payers. And the reality is that Medicaid is an extremely cost-effective program. That's the good news and the bad news about Medicaid. Mm-hmm. It is the lowest per capita spender in our healthcare system. So when you hear Medicaid costs are out of control, they're not. Our healthcare costs are out of control, but that's not Medicaid's. Medicaid's are lower than everybody else's. And again, that's the good news and the bad news, because sometimes we have access problems in Medicaid because those costs are low. So these questions, like the prescription drug question, is really something that has to be thought of across payers, in my view. And frankly, getting back to the previous issue, I think all of us here would agree, and Josh said it right up front, that long-term care is sort of the elephant in the room. That's a deficiency in the Medicare program that Medicaid has had to pick up. So these are broad questions. You know, unfortunately, I worry that the capacity of our political system is unable to respond to them. But really, these are the kinds of broader issues that we need to address.
Speak to the tensions over the expansion in the Deep South, and particularly how you see it playing out in states like Louisiana. You have a Democratic government and a very Republican legislature and congressional delegation.
Louisiana is an interesting case because it was a Republican legislature that effectively gave the go-ahead to whoever won the election next, and it was the Democrat in that case. you know, I think this is a situation where, again, we're going to be a broken record, where the financing matters. And so if the financing changes at the federal level as kind of currently envisioned, starting in 2020, I could very well see Louisiana saying, we're not going to enroll any new people in expansion. If you're on expansion, you stay at the enhanced match rate, no new enrollees, if the state has the flexibility to do that. I think they're a good case study of kind of, there wasn't, and we watched the Louisiana debate a little bit, there wasn't actually really a public debate about it. It kind of just happened. Whereas in other states, it was very public. It was on the front page all the time. It was very contentious in the legislature. It just kind of like petered out, and the authority was granted in Louisiana effectively. So I think that's where the dollars and cents discussion is going to come in Louisiana to play out.
Well, I think the governor ran on it.
Well, the governor ran on it. Yeah, correct. Yeah, sure. So when he is in office, right, he will do what he can to try to say we want to keep it.
Yes.
I have a waiver question. I'm trying to think of which state it was. It was a Midwest state that did not expand dealing with the coverage gap. And there was an analysis done at the state level recommending to use 1352s to let to basically bring the expansion population from other states into more better subsidized exchange plans. And then I've also heard kind of the idea floating around of letting people on the bronze plans who aren't getting coverage that they want or very low income buy into Medicaid, Medicaid managed care plans using 1115. Do you have thoughts of those proposals?
They're real. I think the 1332 challenge will be, and it was, it will likely be much more open and opportunistic in this administration. But the challenge is twofold. One is it still has the statutory requirement not to increase the federal deficit, which is kind of a challenge for a state because we don't even really understand how the budget works federally, let alone be able to achieve that. But I think. The bigger issue would be the money. You know, if right now those folks have Medicaid money and you can only get the money through expansion, could there be some kind of middle ground where instead of the Medicaid expansion money, it can go to a 1332 kind of option, and in which case that's like the basic health plan kind of model that some states are playing with. But it's all about can you make the money work and can you make the subsidies deep enough so that people can really afford the coverage. But I think those are some of the kinds of middle ground discussions that need to happen. You know, could you, in the ACA, could you think about a provision where you more deeply subsidize some basic plans, the young adult plans, and then have a reinsurance provision to protect the pool when they come in for real care? All of those things are possible, but in this environment, it seems to me nobody's talking about where you could have repairs.
Yeah, I just say that on the 1332s, we've heard a lot of chatter about that at the state level, mainly by consultants who want to get paid to do reports for states, quite frankly. I think it's very difficult for states to do anything meaningful other than single payer through them. And because the four statutory guardrails require certain things that unless you're getting a ton more money, well, let me put one caveat. If a state were allowed to I don't think they're allowed to do this, but this has been the argument made at the states. If a state were to reform using an 1115 waiver and take some of the savings and apply it to a 1332 type population, that might work in the statutory guardrails. I don't think that's allowed. So I think that's a challenge to be able to make that a reality. And so therefore, you just have a lot of states nibbling around the edges on 1332s, nothing that's really that big. Now, if the Patient and State Stabilization Fund that's in the American Healthcare Act were to pass, changes the discussion.
It does.
I mean, $130 billion over a few-year period changes the discussion. But that money's not forever. So the discussion would just resurface again about who's paying for it in a couple of years.
And it may not be enough.
It's also supposed to go to high-risk pools.
Or reinsurance, right?
Yeah.
Reinsurance. It could go to reinsurance. Yeah. It could do the invisible reinsurance.
Do you have any sense of when we'll see the decision on the Kentucky waiver, and then what happens next? Will there be a fight? They wouldn't be able to implement the work rules right away?
I don't know what you've heard.
Well, we were originally told by the Bevin administration they expected a decision in August or September of last year. Or they applied and they were expecting like a month or so. And I said, yeah, unlikely, for a variety of reasons. So, no, I don't think we have any idea when they're going to rule on it. I do think it'll probably be the first one, though, because it's been sitting there for so long. Yeah, CMS has been actively making calls to states and saying, we're really open, please send us your ideas. So there's one sitting right in front of them on their desk. So I think they don't really have an option. Maybe Arizona will push them to rule on it quicker. As far as a legal challenge, you'd have to have standing. So it'd have to go into effect first. Somebody would have to fail the work requirement, I think, or work whatever it is. Before they could sue, that would probably take quite a while. So it'd be up and running, I would think, for quite a while before we'd had some sort of legal resolution.
States couldn't sue if the state wants to say based on what they have to do to set it up, but they're not going to be suing.
Well, given that they asked for it, probably not. Unless it was a change of
policy. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think we're going to see it in the next couple months. I think it seems like there's a logjam right now at CMS because it's been sort of slow to have new folks coming in, and folks probably know Elliot Fishman, who's been the head of the waiver division, is leaving, I think, next week. So, you know, these things take time to write the terms and conditions. So we had heard very quickly, but now we've heard, you know, slower. And so, but I would say in the next few months. I guess I do want to make a radical suggestion that please don't just cover the work requirement. I get a little frustrated by the amount of discourse on the work requirement. I think as a practical matter, I think the work requirement is a bad idea. And I can go into why, but I won't at the moment in the interest of time. But having said that, I think at the end of the day, it's sucking all the oxygen out of the room, and there are other really important issues that are not getting addressed. And I'm going to give one example. The Florida legislature, the House, just moved a bill a couple weeks ago that literally this came out of nowhere. Okay, it was a managed care bill. They were doing things that they had kind of, you know, prepared and moved along in, like, the middle of the night. The chair of the committee seemed to add a work requirement for, now they don't have expansion in Florida. So sort of like, who are you going to apply the work requirement to? Well, you're going to apply it, apparently he was going to apply it to the TANF parents there who are below 34% of poverty. So we are talking about homeless and near homeless, very poor parents. More dramatically, the bill includes premiums of $10 for every person on the program in Florida, starting at 50% of poverty, $15 starting at 101% of poverty. There are no exclusions written into the language. Now, maybe they're going to change it along the way. This would, I would hazard to say, this would throw off thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of children from Florida's Medicaid program. Children are half of the enrollees in Florida's Medicaid program. Nobody talked about that. Everybody talked about the work requirement. And this is what I mean when it is really important to think about some of these other kinds of issues that I mentioned in my sort of outline about ways in which enrollment will be explicitly limited or implicitly limited through things like premiums.
Can you give us other examples?
Of things to watch? Sure. So I think along with the premiums, there are other provisions that we have seen. One provision which I find especially troubling is something called the lockout. This is in Indiana's proposal. It's also being proposed in a few other states. And it is in Indiana right now. It's when you have a premium and you don't pay your premium, you miss the premium, and you are then locked out for 6 months, although the state used to do 12 months. So essentially what it's saying is if you miss your premium payment, which these are very vulnerable families living below the poverty line, these things happen. Even if it was paid back, you're still locked out.
If you're below the poverty level in Indiana, you're not locked out. You can only be locked out if
you're above the poverty. It's 100 to 138, but I believe there are efforts to apply that below the poverty level.
Sure.
In other states coming, and Indiana wants to go to 12 months, and they also want to expand it to apply to failure to renew in a timely manner.
Yeah, but again,
so
this comes down to,
is
it a welfare program or not? And if you look at data from welfare programs, when sanctions, they call them sanctions, when the stricter sanction you have, typically the less frequently states use it. It's counterintuitive, but I think there's some thinking there along those lines that if you have an actual penalty, then you'll use it less and folks will follow through. If you believe that it is a helpful, if you believe that it is a helpful provision of leading to success in that program, whatever, however you're defining success, then if you have an actual penalty, then you'll use it less is what the takeaway from the welfare side of things is. You might disagree with that. I'm just explaining the rationale for why these sorts of things exist and why they're implemented.
So in my view, the lockout, which we're seeing more and more of in different contexts, is a very damaging policy to impose in a healthcare environment. It means people who are falling on troubles or hard times for whatever reason are being forced to be uninsured for a period of time. Their conditions will worsen. They'll be more expensive. It's counterproductive.
I think you're assuming that.
Well, but you have to get inside the lives of these families. I mean, the notion of personal responsibility, breaking the cycle of poverty, teaching new habits, and the Indiana thing's kind of interesting because there's incentives if you don't have to pay if you participate in a wellness program. you can argue, those are all commendable goals. What you have to think about, and I ran a subsidized health insurance program in Maine. These families, when the car breaks, there's no money to pay. They can't go to work. When, you know, the kinds of, the heating bill goes up. When you live on the edge, making a monthly payment every single month at the same time is really hard. So the issue is, even if you believe that these payments are important and they're parts of personal responsibilities, the reality of these lives is being able to make that payment on the 10th of every month when your rent check's due and when the car breaks down or that something happens in the house or the kid's sick and needs prescriptions that aren't covered. You can't make the payment. It's not that you don't want them, and it's not that you can't a couple of weeks later. So there's grace periods attached to many of these kinds of provisions, and that's an administrative expense. So in many states, what you'll do if you see some kind of requirement, there's a grace period to pay up. But then you have to manage the grace period.
I just want to suggest you have to think about this a little bit more holistically. We're giving homeless people Medicaid cards that only show up to the ER. I want folks to get access to care, but I also want a homeless person to need to have a home first. So my point is how you structure the program to get value in what you spend dollars on first and how people actually interact with the program. I mean, ask Medicaid departments to ask for their ER utilization rates. It's terrible. It's terrible. And there's a variety of reasons, I mean, you know this so well, reasons why. So are we getting value? So let's not just make this a purely emotional argument, which, look, I have had family members on Medicaid, so this isn't like some distant thing for me. But I also know that there's a lot of problems with this program and how it's structured. And so for us to just say, you tweak here, oh, the world ends, versus actually stepping back and saying, well, maybe we need to reprioritize. Maybe we do need to change dramatically the structure of the program for different people. I think that's a fair discussion to be had, and we frequently don't have that.
So, yeah, Chris, and then we'll start to wrap up.
I mean, this goes back to some of the things that have already been said, but just it struck me listening to this last discussion. It really seems like there are sort of two different points that are being made. There's this point that it seems almost indisputable that you need to find some way to sort of look at sort of holistically at people's lives and to de-silo, and this has almost become sort of a truism in sort of social policy debates. But the problem, it seems like, in this Medicaid discussion is that that's always coupled when people say, oh, let's have these mega waivers. It always seems to be coupled with, and let's cut 25%. And the question I guess I have is, how do you find a way, I mean, maybe there's just no way politically, how do you find a way to decouple those two conversations so you can have sort of an everybody in discussion to do the kind of tweaks that you were just talking about without having people feel like, well, wait a minute, if I sort of grant that we're going to have these tweaks and going to sort of make things more flexible, then I'm in for, but we're also going to cut the resources when states are already stretched, there's already this poverty program. How do you decouple these two discussions?
I think the waivers do. If you look at Washington and Oregon particularly, they have very comprehensive waivers around these community care organizations where for the first time, they'll be able to use Medicaid funds to fund some of the social determinants to deal with homelessness. The question, so it's a beginning step. Medicaid can't be the piggy bank for the social determinants of health. So it's a beginning step, and then the next step is, and I think Josh had a great idea, you need to end the silos federally of the housing agencies and the social supports that have fundamentally different rules and regulations about who's eligible for services. So, you know, you need to braid those funds in different ways, and I think this administration might actually allow that to happen.
So let's wrap up by just, I want to ask you all about just that, because we've been talking about the states and the waivers and what the states can do because we didn't pass this federal legislation. But, you know, every time, I've heard so many times during this conversation, but it depends what the federal government does, you know, because everything, that could change everything. So I'd love to know what all three of you know and are thinking about how we move forward on the federal front. You know, Josh, you talked about the mega waivers, and you said that that's something that Paul Ryan could support potentially. So what are you all hearing about if we come back to another piece of legislation? Are we talking about something that looks like the last piece of legislation? Have we grown since then? Have we moved beyond that? Where are we? Where do you think we're going?
So yeah, I think it's going to look a lot. It's going to move through the House in a very similar way that it looks now. There'll be some more tweaks. Probably not on the Medicaid side, though, because there's a very delicate balance from a financing standpoint and with tax reform coming that relies somewhat on the Medicaid provisions. So I don't think you can do much there. The other thing to be aware of is that in the Senate, you have more Republicans who are from non-expansion states as a percentage of their caucus than you have in the House, which is a 50-50 split. So it is a different dynamic over there. I realize there are some big differences between the chambers, but I think it's going to look pretty similar. I think the real discussion we're all interested in is does the per capita cap proposal change and how does it change? And there's already been some chatter on the Senate side, a couple expansion state senators weighing in about it, but not being overly specific about what they want. We've got some folks already saying, I'm concerned about the growth of Medicaid, so that will be pressure. So I'm not sure there's a clear path, as there frequently isn't in the Senate, on what tweaks there, but it can't change much if they actually want it to pass in a timely manner and get their tax reform.
So on the legislative side, I would say I am certainly not going to prognosticate on what's going to happen with the bill. I would agree with Josh. I don't think the Medicaid provisions will change that much. I think the fundamental question when you're thinking about Medicaid policy going forward is if we have a legislative change, we're talking about huge cuts to Medicaid. If states are operating in a context where we don't have a legislative change and they're operating in the waiver world, then it's a very different story, because typically governors come and ask for more money in waivers, not less. So it's just a whole different dynamic depending on whether you're looking at a very significant cut and a radical restructuring of the finance legislative context versus the waiver. I would just throw out to you, CHIP is up, needs to be extended by September 30th this year. As Trish and I were discussing, that's extremely late and unhelpful for states for it to happen that way. But the point is, that's something that Congress must do. It's my hope that Congress can move together in a bipartisan way to keep it separate from these other contentious issues like Medicaid, like the ACA, and just do something. You know, there's a lot of bipartisan support for CHIP, so just do a clean and quick extension. I don't know if we're going to see that, and whether or not the CHIP debate will become also get enmeshed in these Medicaid issues we've been discussing.
And if it doesn't happen in the summer, states will have no choice but to start to disenroll children, because you can't wait till October when the program, the funds end. You know, you have to give notice. You have to deal with your contracts. You have lots of work to do to unbundle a program. So waiting is not an option to states that late. I can't predict I'm a statey. It's just confusing. I think states want certainty. It's just decide and give us some kind of certainty about where we're headed congressionally, because it's just too frustrating, and it makes it really difficult for states to negotiate with their legislatures over budgets and to try to plan the programs in a place of such gross uncertainty. But I do think we can expect states and the administration to be creative and active in the waiver realm, and we'll see really significant action there, I suspect.
All right, so two quick things. First of all, in your packet on the right side, you have an experts list that tells you how to contact our speakers today, and it also has a list of other experts if you'd like to follow up. Also, you have a little blue sheet. We make this evaluation as short and painless as we possibly can, and we really do look at it to see who you want to hear from. What topics you'd like us to bring to you in these discussions. We will continue these discussions thanks to Ted Giovannis of the JKTG Foundation. And so be on the lookout for more advisories from us. And thank you so much to our panel today for a really, really rich and helpful discussion. And we realize we just scratched the surface, so more to come. Thank you, everybody, and thank you so much for being here.